We're packed today on a Friday before the divisional round games in the NFL, the Ryan Russillo podcast. I am Ryan. Thank you for listening, Ringer and Spotify. And we'll break it all down for you coming up here in just a minute. It's the Ryan Russillo podcast presented by FanDuel. Take a shot at betting the NBA with FanDuel, America's number one sports book. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting the Explore page and the Pulse and bet live same-game parlays for every NBA game. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available. And listen to the end of the episode for additional details. Must be 21 and older and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
Okay, so here's the plan for today. Damon John is going to join us from Shark Tank. Really excited about this. His background, being on Shark Tank, different investment stuff, some of the stuff that I don't understand about how the show works, which is cool. And I just wanted to kind of ask him, like, hey, all right, 2020, like, what have you been investing in? What would you start looking at? And he was so honest about it. So that was great. And then Phil Simms, CBS, 15 years in the league, story time, Coach Parcells. Also, you know, kind of his read on the Brady Belichick thing over the years. We'll get his picks for both the NFC and AFC title games. And we'll do life advice. So there you go. That's the show for today. This is going to be fun. Getting ready for the conference title games. We got Phil Simms, CBS, and of course, longtime quarterback. So, you know, a lot of us spent a lot of time on who Rodgers was. I brought this up. So my audience is going, are you doing this Rodgers question again? And I always want to ask everybody, okay, where were you with him the last couple of years, the quarterback that you saw? And now how do you compare that to a season where he's maybe on his way to another Super Bowl and an MVP?
Well, how do I compare him? Well, look, he has definitely not lost any talent. I do think, and well, I know, I don't have to ask him or whatever, because I watch and study these guys and all that, that he spent more time working on being a quarterback this offseason than he probably has in years before. And I actually heard a statement by him that he went back to squatting weights and doing things like that to get his legs stronger, bigger, whatever. And I, you know, Ryan, I noticed that early in the year. I said, Aaron Rodgers, you know, he looks bigger. And he was. And then when I heard that story, I go, okay, good. That validates what I saw. But his throwing's been as good as ever. That's awesome to watch. It's amazing the way he can – we talk about Patrick Mahomes and Tom Brady's arm, which is – but nobody can flick the ball and from all angles and spin it, falling backwards, better than Aaron Rodgers. And it's been fun to watch. And honestly – I look at these championship games real quick and just go, I almost feel sorry for the quarterback that loses in these games, just because they've all had great years. And, well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we have Dilfer on all the time. I worked with him and become pretty close. And you know, he was early on and he goes, Aaron was just pissed off about the Jordan Love pick. And that's what happened. I go, God, it just seems so ridiculous that you, if you were Rodgers, you'd have to be that motivated. Instead of just being motivated by people starting to doubt your ability. But you're right. I mean, he's been stronger. And I thought, all right, you know, if Dilfer's saying it, and it seems to be hinting at kind of what you're not saying Love specifically, but that he seemed motivated this year in a way that he hasn't been motivated for a long time. Is that fair?
Well, yeah, I think so. You know, yeah, when you draft a quarterback in the first round, let's go all the way around. That's slapping you in the face. And, you know, everybody goes, oh, well, it's for the future. Hey, the future's now. you know, everybody talks about the all when we draft him for 3 years down the line. You know, that day's over too. You know, I know Aaron Rodgers sat on the bench for 3 years, but I'm just telling you, it's not over. Now it's, you know, right away, just, you know, do your job and try to build a team. Aaron Rodgers still has plenty of years left in him. And so, yeah, did it motivate him? Yes, I'm sure it did. Did it make him mad? Yes. But also, you know, Matt LaFleur has done a better job of designing the offense. There's more plays in it, more run plays, more format, everything, more movement, all that. That is as big as what Aaron Rodgers is doing also.
Can you get into more specifics on that? Because I like where you're going with that. I always want to try to understand this stuff better. What do you notice as somebody who's played it, you know, been around it your whole life? Like when you go, oh, okay, this is what they're doing a little different offensively under the same coach. Like what are the things you look for and then, you know, are able to like share with us?
One, just the movement is one. And people, you know, you see all the stats and analytics or whatever. But movement does one thing. It makes the defense think a little bit. So make them think. And when they think, they slow down. And that's what you want to try to do. But just being more creative in the run game and being more, what's the word for it? Just staying with it. And there's no doubt the play action pass has turned into a big thing for the Green Bay Packers. And usually when you play action pass, you're not doing it to throw it out in the flat for 2 yards. You're doing it to trying to throw it deep down the field. And my gosh, you got one of the best, strongest arms in NFL history. And he's as accurate as anybody we've ever seen. You know, so take advantage of that. And there's no doubt Matt LaFleur and Nathaniel Hackett, who's, you know, is coordinated in the NFL. And I've always liked what he has done as a coordinator. And you put all these minds together and you get more plays and more ways to beat the other team. And that really is as big a key as anything. Andy Reid, who has more okey-doke plays than him? My gosh. I mean, oh, a shovel pass to Kelsey to the outside, you know, Kelsey running the Wildcats, you know, just the last play of the game last week where Chad Henne is standing there really calm and you think they're going to run the clock out or is he going to try to draw them offside? Everybody's relaxed. The emotions of running back in the backfield. Yeah, we're not going to run a play. Sit hike. And it catches you by surprise. And just think, they practice that to act like we're not going to run a play. So that just goes to show you how important coaching is.
Whenever I would listen to you do a Pats game, I knew it was just different because of your relationship with Bill. And when Bill's there long enough, you're just going to get stuff from Bill that other people just aren't going to get. And then Tom's there forever. And so I wonder, did you get a sense, did you have a better sense of where the Bill-Tom divorce was going than maybe anybody else? Because you've just been around him for so long that maybe you're picking up on things in a conversation or production meeting or some of the things they were pointing out that you go, you know what, you know, Bill eventually will make a change here.
Well, you know, I've been away from doing games for a couple of years, so I kind of missed that end where maybe, but even being from afar, you could hear the words, watch the body language, everything that was going on. That this might not come, this is going to come to a rough ending. And, but they had a great run and those things happened. The team was changing. You know, Brady's disappointed with the people he gets to throw to and do all this other stuff. So, you know, I wasn't shocked when it happened. And, you know, the thing about Tom Brady, just to get away from that subject just for a second, all the times, I think I did close to 90 Patriot games in my broadcasting career when I was doing games. He walked in one week, sat down with me, and we're talking, and, you know, I could see he's got this look on his face. He said, well, so what's going on, big guy? Hey, you know, you think I never completed a pass around here the way they talk to me. And I just went, oh, okay, here we go. And it was, you know, he was just coming in, and he was venting a little, and I said, hey, yeah, that's the life I lived for 15 years, or all, not 15, 8 years with Bill Parcells. No matter what you did, it wasn't, you know, it's just, hey, whatever. And so it was funny. And it was, you know, he played all those years with Bill Belichick. He was always, what's the word for it? They're always on edge. I can say this with complete honesty. Nobody practiced harder and longer than the Patriots of all the teams I watched in the NFL. So, you know, there's a reason why they got it done for so many years. Yes, talent, great coaching, but their work ethic was, Ryan, it was unbelievable to go to a Friday practice and watch them get ready for the game. It was so competitive, so tough and hard. Guys are knocking passes down from Tom Brady. Receivers slip and fall. He's cursing at them. They're cursing back. I'm going, this is, you know, and there'd be times I'd go, when's this practice going to end? I mean, I've had enough. I already know everything they're going to do now. And so just to follow it, you understood why they won, why they did. And of course, Tom Brady's carried a lot of those things down to Tampa Bay with.
Was it like that for you with Parcells? Was it the same kind of deal on a Friday? Is that where Belichick gets it from?
Well, it was the same practice schedule. Absolutely. You know, listen, we practiced hard every day with the Giants. There was never, oh, let's go out and sweat and let you guys rest. We didn't have, not once in my career did he, in the 8 years with Bill, did we ever do that. I mean, his big thing was, it's Friday, guys. I'm going to let you take the pads out of your pants. But by God, we better have a good practice or I'll never take them out again. And, you know, you're like, wow, Bill, you're so nice. We get to take our thigh pads out. You know, it was pretty hilarious. But Wednesdays and Thursdays, where they were miniature football games. That's for real. They were. They were very physical and a lot of hitting. Thank God I wasn't a lineman or a linebacker or whatever. It was really something else. And, you know, I don't know how guys did it, but they did it because that was their job and that's how you kept it, by practicing hard.
Do you end up just disliking a Parcells the whole time you're working with him and appreciating him after the fact? I mean, we've all seen the videos. You know, I know you've done this interview a million different times, but it feels like one of those relationships where you, as you mature, you understand how important it is, but in the moment, it's just tough.
And no, look, we yelled at each other, not as much as people portray it, of course. He was just a very demanding guy. And then quite honestly, Ryan, he used me to talk to the team.
Yeah.
You know, so yell at me and let everybody else hear it. So it maybe would keep them on edge too. And sometimes he would warn me before practice, Sims, listen, I'm proud of you, son. You're doing great. You're playing. You're leading. I just want you to know today, I'm going to destroy you. I'm going to yell at you. And I just go, damn, can't we wait to practice to see what I'm doing? And he goes, hey, listen, I got to do it. These other guys, they're all driving me nuts. And I just go, okay. So as soon as I threw one bad pass, did something wrong, he would just, you know, flip out, scream and yell. And all the players loved it. When he yelled at you, if you were one of the other guys, you could laugh. And he liked that. It was like he was playing to the crowd. But it was his way of delivering messages. And I don't know how many guys, I could probably name them out, but there was probably about 6 to 8 guys. Well, probably about 6 that he would use this kind of tactic with to talk to the whole team through that player. And one of them was Lawrence Taylor. Every once in a while, he would actually get on Lawrence, just a few times, Ryan, not many, but he would yell at Lawrence and, you know, say things. And, you know, of course the players loved it. Oh, Lawrence. Oh my gosh. You're getting mad at, you know, it was pretty funny to see the reaction from the players when he would, you know, pick on Lawrence a little bit.
What would Lawrence say back to him?
Oh, nothing. You know, he would laugh almost. Okay, Bill, come on, be quiet. You know, I mean, Lawrence would talk back and make fun of Bill too. You know, Lawrence, the famous thing once, we were playing the Eagles. Back-to-back plays, he ran the wrong defense. But he hit the quarterback one and sacked in the other one. And Bill screaming at him because of the field, Lawrence, you're doing the wrong. And he goes, well, you know, whatever I'm doing, Bill, we should put it in because it's working. And whatever. It was like so funny. And Bill screaming at him, you made mistakes. And then, you know, we get it the other way. It was hilarious. But, you know, Bill, did he treat Lawrence different? Of course. He had to. I mean, one, he was the best player in the team. He's a big reason why we won 2 Super Bowls. And, you know, that old rule, I treat everybody the same. Well, we all know that's not true. And Lawrence did get special treatment, and that's just because he delivered on the field.
Yeah, I would think he, at least what he did on the field, was going to back up some of that treatment. I love, you know, that era of football in the mid-80s for me, you know, being younger at that time and really paying attention to it. And then kind of, you know, that part of just feeling like America where you go, okay, it's Sunday and this is what I'm doing. You know, I was more of a basketball kid growing up, but that run that the Bears had was cool for kids. And then your run where you were incredible in 86. But if you go back to that game at Chicago against the 85 Bears defense, you get shut out 21-0. What's the lasting memory from that game and how brutal it had to have been to go up against that team and then carrying that over into the next year?
Well, one, the weather that day was truly the roughest weather I ever played in. It was, I don't know how cold it was, around zero, but it was really windy, and it was something. I went one side, one time I came off the field, I went to the sideline to get a drink, and I picked up the cup, and all everything was frozen. And I just, you know, knocked it over. Well, all right, I guess I'm not drinking any water here in the first half, but whatever. But, you know, we got down to what was the memory? The chances. We're on the one-inch line. And we don't score. We drop a perfect touchdown throw. And then we run it, whatever. We don't score. Then we miss the field goal. Then Sean Lindetta is punting and misses the ball. So, you know, those things. So we took that out of that. But also we took out of the respect for the Bears and knew that, okay, we're pretty good. But we got to go to another level to beat this team and to, you know, to really, truly win a Super Bowl. And I've heard many coaches tell me all these things and say, getting to the championship game is one thing. Winning a Super Bowl is just a whole nother level. And, you know, I think we found that out playing the Bears, not only their talent, but the defense was unique. That 46 defense. I mean, I just remember going, wait, they're going to line up where? And this is what? I mean, it was really, we worked on them in training camp that year quite a bit, thinking we would see them in the playoffs. And thank God we did, because, you know, linebackers are lining up where the safety is. The safety's over here as a linebacker. Who's this? And identifying what you were going to do was really hard. But more importantly, you know, the talent on the defensive side was, it was just off the charts. There was not a weakness. And if there was, you couldn't get to it because the pass rush and the complexity of what they did would just overwhelm you.
And so that next year you go 14-2, and the San Francisco team, you've gone back and forth within the playoffs the last couple of years. You trounce them. You shut out Washington. There'll be guys that I can talk to before Super Bowl week that will say, oh, we knew. You know, look, there's plenty of guys that are really confident, like, oh, we got this. And then, you know, you lose 28-10 and you go, what happened? You're like, oh, yeah, you know.
Right.
Where were you at as a team? Because it still felt, I don't know if it felt new to you. You've been in the league a few years. You've been in the playoffs now for three, so you had success. So it wasn't like it was overnight, but you were just a completely different team from 85 to 86 based on record and the defense picking things up. So where were you going into that matchup against Denver?
Well, the difference was in 86, we won the close games. And, you know, we went through really a rough year, you know, with 14. I mean, there were times, and Jeff Hostetler was a wide receiver for me. I mean, it was like they fell like flies. Every game, we'd lose a wide receiver. And who's going to play this week? You know, my tight ends, Mark Bavaro and Zeke Mowat, who were both very good, were missing time and hurt. It was a struggle. I mean, there is no other way around it. But we always found a way on a couple on the last drives of the game, whatever it was, the defense holding the team out, what to win many close games. But we started getting healthy at the end of the year, and we really got hot. And you know, where we felt invincible. And going into the Super Bowl that I never thought about, and I don't remember just going, oh, we're going to win. We're just better than them. Man, you know, that Denver team was loaded. And we played them during the season, and we beat them on the last drive. You know, I'm hit two passes at the end of the game. We're going to lose. I hit like about a third and 20. I threw a 25-yard in cut and hit it to keep a drive going. Otherwise, we're going to punt, and they're probably going to beat us. And then we hit another big play, and then we kick a field goal and win the game. So that was the team I thought we were going to face in the Super Bowl, and we did. But again, you know, even in the Super Bowl, we made timely, big-time plays on both sides of the ball. Bill Parcells went for it on fourth, back when people didn't do this, fourth and one, I think at about our own 40-something, you know, which was just unheard of back then. He did that, and the defense, of course, our defense is just like an offense. When they got rolling, oh my gosh, and our defense was rolling. I think John Elway went through three straight three and outs, and we scored all three times. And a lot of it was just because we had great field position, and, you know, it started falling together. But never did I think that, oh, this is a shoe-in, anything like that. And, you know, I always think about it all the time. Why didn't I play the way I did that game in certain times more in my career? And it's really just a mindset a lot of times. You know, it's just no matter what happens, it doesn't detract you. In other words, you know, football, Ryan, it's just nothing but adversity. It always goes wrong. And how you deal with it is just a bit really big. Sometimes I throw an interception, go, oh, I can't throw another one. And, you know, you're like, you know, that's all you're thinking about. And then sometimes I throw one and people go, don't worry about it. So, hey, look, I ain't worried about it. Be ready to tackle because I might throw six today. So here we go. And it's unbelievable. Just that process. And that's how Bill wanted you to think. This is a true story. Walking out of the locker room in 1984, Bill was standing there kind of watching us walk out. And I'm walking by. He goes, hey, Sims. I look at him. He goes, listen, if you don't throw two interceptions today, you're not taking enough chances. Let it go. And I'm like, well, okay, I can take care of that interception part. Don't worry about that. But, you know, that was his way of taking the pressure off of you and letting you play because he always believed, man, you got to play with certain abandon to be who you are and to be good enough to win big time games.
Yeah. And you were basically perfect in that Super Bowl against Denver. So, of all the times to step up, did you have a feeling though? Did you? Like, could you tell with certain teammates, all right, this guy, like the stress to him, he may be okay, but he's not comfortable. Where did you feel more comfortable as the stakes were raised? Because I think that's a real thing that anybody who's ever played sports understands.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. You know, I just was at the point in my life, I didn't care. I was going to play. And, you know, I'd read stories. I can say that Ron Jaworski and Joe Theismann, I remember reading something and they just said they were saying that they couldn't focus in the Super Bowl because it was just so much, so big and so much pressure that it took them somewhere in the second quarter to settle down. I remember thinking, man, if I ever get there, I'm not going to waste a quarter. And, you know, I thought about it and just was in that mindset. And Bill Parcells and I talked about it all week that week. Just let it go. I said, hey, we practiced unbelievable and we've been playing the same way and it carried over. But that was the mindset. And Bill was really great in that way. You know, he pressured us every day in practice for real. It was torture. It was so much pressure in practice. And that week we practiced so well that one time it was on Friday. He actually stopped practice. He goes, all right, that's enough. He goes, damn, let's don't leave it on the field. And he got nervous because we were so in tune that even he got concerned that maybe we were, I don't know, peaking, whatever. Don't leave it on the field, all those things. And we actually stopped practice probably about 30 minutes before we used it. And that was the only time in my career we ever stopped practice early, trust me. And so it took us a while, but that kind of carried over into the Super Bowl as the game went on.
So if we go all the way back then to the beginning of what we're doing, because that was awesome, and looking at that NFC game, I mean, are you picking Green Bay because they're at home, or do you think Tom can pull this off?
Well, I think Tom can pull it off. There's no question. And, yeah. You know, I just don't look at Tom. I just look at matchups. You know, just when you think of Tampa Bay, they're big, they're powerful, they got playmakers. You know, that's a great combination. So does Green Bay, but Green Bay is not as big as Tampa Bay is and powerful. So my one concern for Green Bay, don't let Tampa just line up and pound the ball at you. You know, we saw that last year with Green Bay as they got run on. They had about five games last year where they just got overpowered by the other team's offense. And I'm not saying it'll be as severe as that, but if you let them control it and, you know, now you got a lot of matchups. When you look at what Tampa Bay can put out there. So there's many ways for Tampa Bay to win this game. And Vita Vea is going to be back this week inside. How good will he be? I know he's not off an injury reserve. I'm not sure. But I got to read. I don't really read the injury reports until the day before the game. And I even scoff at them sometimes. We have to wait to game day. But he is a big factor inside. Everybody thinks he's a run stopper. Really, he's a pass rusher. And from the inside, that's a dangerous thing. So that'll be interesting. But the other thing is, just can Tampa Bay win? Yes. But Aaron Rodgers in this offense is different. They are at home. And I think this, I was thinking about this yesterday. When you're the visiting team in the playoffs, for some reason, you feel no pressure. It's great. They hate us, whatever fans are going to be there. They hate us, whatever. It just puts you in a different mindset. was not a guy that got nervous before games, but I can say I might have been a little more uptight at home. On the road, I was never nervous just because I loved it. The fact, yell at us, scream at us, it kind of bonds you together, brings you together as a team and as players. And sometimes that's enough to give you an edge so you can win the game.
This year, looking at Kansas City's defense, it's just, you know, it depends on kind of where you're at with it, where I would look at the numbers and go, all right, you know, they're not great. The closing part of the season, like, all right, fine. But then when it comes to it, they're up 19-3, then Mahomes goes out. So, you know, I'm not going to look at what happened throughout the entirety of last week to try to get a read on this. But I look at a Bills team that has been probably the best offense in the league in the second half of the season, and a Chiefs defense that at this point, it's certainly not a strength. So is there enough there to exploit for Buffalo to pull this one off?
Yes. Buffalo can win this game just because their quarterback is who he is. I mean, you know, Josh Allen, I don't want people to take it wrong, but he is Patrick Mahomes in many ways. He can get away from anybody. He's very big. I mean, when you meet him in person, have you ever met him? I mean, you'll be shocked at how big he is. I mean, he's 6'5", and he is not skinny. And his power, his ability to throw the ball anywhere, running left, throwing right, whatever it is, he can do it. And make no doubt about it, everything they're going to do is going to be centered around him. They actually, their team is centered around more of their quarterback than I think that Kansas City's is. I mean, Kansas City's got weapons galore. And they got playmakers, you know, on both sides of the ball. But who has a better, maybe Tampa Bay, but who has a receiving core that can match what Kansas City can put out here? And then they got the wild card. You think it's Tyreek Hill. Really, the wild card is Travis Kelce, because who matches up with him? Things like that. And I think for Buffalo to win, Josh Allen will have to be really, really good and have, I'm not going to say the game of his life, but man, it's got to be close to that for them to win. But just because of where they're at as a football team, they're a little undersized on the defensive side. They're fast, but they're still undersized. And how they will play the game will absolutely be different than how they play Kansas City in week 6. And I expect Kansas City to also change the way they played too. So I looked at week 6, saw the game and go, well, I just wasted a lot of time because neither team's going to play this way when we come to Sunday. So it's going to be interesting to see how aggressive Buffalo is, especially on the defensive side, and what they do on the offensive side. I'll give you one quick example. I don't know the exact number. I forgot. Buffalo's playing Baltimore. How many passes did he start the game throwing with? 15, whatever?
Oh, well, that game, it was 19 called passes. He ran one, but it was a pass. It was 19. He ran one. The first 19 play calls were passes.
Well, you know why? Because they didn't want to waste a play. They go, well, why are we going to try to run? We can't run against this defensive line that they got over there. They had five D linemen basically across the board. So why waste a play? Let's throw it. Our best guys, Josh Allen, throw it. And all we got to do is get hot for a few minutes. And I thought it was a great – not only that, it tires the defense out. How many times can you rush the passer, Ryan, when you think about it? You know, these defensive linemen, I watch it, and this is stuff I do. And, you know, every time I just watch, and all of a sudden in the second half, then I go, look at the D linemen. They're tired because you can only rush the passer so many times and before you give out. And, you know, I saw that a little bit in the game with Baltimore. I saw it last week with the Cleveland Browns versus Kansas City. Kansas City's defensive line got tired at times in that game. And when they did, Baker Mayfield was having success throwing the ball down the field. So that's going to be an interesting aspect. Can Josh Allen and the Bills offense hit enough plays to get in rhythm and then really stress Kansas City's defense to a point where they get tired, and then you can really take advantage of them? And what does that do? That only gives you a great chance of staying in the game, because not many people think really deep down that Buffalo can go out there and beat them because of who they have, who their quarterback is, about Andy Reid, and the fact that they're defending Super Bowl champions. I mean, if you pick Buffalo, you're doing it just because you love them, and you just go, you want to see something different. I don't know. But it's hard to just sit there and say, oh, I think Buffalo definitely is going to win this game. I don't know anybody that's saying that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I guess the one thing about that Baltimore game where I thought the wind played such a factor in Allen's deep throws, because he had three or four that weren't even close. Like, they weren't even close. Now, I thought Buffalo was still the better football team, and maybe the wind conditions aren't going to be the same. You know, I don't know what the weather's going to be in comparison to that. But I'm with you. We're in agreement.
Well, now, here's the real quick thing about the wind, and especially for a guy like Josh Allen. Now, if you notice, even Lamar overthrew somebody. And Josh Allen, what happens when you're throwing downwind? You can't throw it up in the air. You got to put it on the line. Now, he could line drive a ball 55 or 60 yards probably, for real. And, you know, I mean, he might put a little arc on it, but he's not going to put it up in the air where the wind affects the ball. The football, when you're throwing downwind, yeah, it carries, but the nose doesn't turn over, so it just keeps sliding in the air and goes. And, yeah, he probably threw that first deep ball where he had a chance to – the receiver was open, and he really overthrew it because he had to go, oh, my gosh. The ball went 65 yards in the air, and he flicked it. He put, like, zero effort into it. And the same thing happened to Lamar, and the same thing happened to the backup quarterback for the Baltimore Ravens. He came in. I'm sure when he threw the ball, he went, that felt pretty good. Oh, my God, it's 15 yards over the receiver's head, because that's what the wind does. For a really good quarterback, they'd almost prefer to throw into the wind just because you know what you're dealing with. When it's downwind, man, that wind catches it right, it's just going to go a lot longer than you think. And, oh, what was my last thing I wanted to tell you about the Buffalo game? You were saying something. Oh, and see, the thing about Buffalo, they do it every week. Today we're this. Tomorrow we're going to be that. And here the next day we're this on the defensive side. So they played Indianapolis one way, and they played an entirely, I can't even explain it to you, an entirely unbelievable defense against Baltimore. They basically just said, Lamar, whatever you want to do, throw it, but we're going to kill if you run. And they did. You know, they were blitzing people, doing things. Hey, they play Kansas City. It's the most conservative defensive game plan you've ever seen in history. They play Baltimore. It might be the most aggressive one you've ever watched. And so that's what's pretty really cool about Buffalo, is they're just willing to adapt week to week against whoever they play, where most teams go, we're just going to play the system. Our system, we trust our system. Well, you know, systems sometimes don't match up against who you're playing. So that to me, that's going to be a really interesting thing just to watch as a guy that does this for a living and as a fan, just to see how each team decides to play each other this weekend. So I'll leave you with that.
Can't wait, Phil. It's going to be awesome.
All right, buddy. Hey, look, you have a great day. Great to talk to you, man.
Yeah, you too. Absolutely, Phil. This is cool. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you, Ryan.
Okay. Big thanks to Phil Sims. Knew that would be great. Coming up next, though, from Shark Tank, Damon John. This episode is brought to you by Arby's, the perfect sandwich. Let me think. Buffalo chicken sandwiches done right can change your life. I've never been the same in the best way possible when I experienced my first one. Also loving to travel, I've had gyros, also known as gyros. I think if you go to Arby's and you order a gyro, they're not going to judge you. And that's what I like about them. Nice chicken, perfectly sauced, butter lettuce, good body. You know what I'm talking about. And that's what Arby's has. They have more than you may even realize. Get out there and explore. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's Rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com. You know Damon John from Shark Tank. He's obviously an author, 5 books now, entrepreneur, a guy that has an amazing story, and I can't wait to chat with him right now about it. So let's start with Shark Tank, only because I wonder, can you figure it out in like 2 seconds, yes or no? Like, yeah, you know, you probably want to learn about it a little more, but I bet the instinct-wise, it probably feels like your gut is probably as right as anything.
No, believe it or not, no.
No kidding.
No, because, you know, we get thrown for loops. You know, we don't know anything about the people. That's why. So it's not like somebody came in prior to you and prior to the person saying, hey, I got my guy, or this woman has a great idea and they're doing some real business. You need to listen to them, right? So as soon as they come in, you know, you hear the story first and, You know, we allow them, I think, 3 minutes or something, or maybe 2 minutes to get the story out before jumping down there. Let them go through their whole little vaudeville act. And then we ask them the questions. And sometimes I've been like, you know, but, you know, I can start picking up fairly early. Most of us can, because they go, and then we did this, and man, people have been waiting. Have been waiting? Wait a minute. Have been waiting? Oh, you don't have no sales. So, you know, we don't know right away. And then sometimes you have the one or two times where you're like, man, I'm out of here. This guy's an idiot. And then all of a sudden he goes, I got $1.2 million in sales. Oh my God, you are really, really amazing. I was about to, I wrote you off as a, you know, as a moron. You're not as much of a moron as I thought. So a short answer.
Yeah, but no, that makes sense. Cause you're right. I've been tricked watching the show. I guess sometimes I feel like, especially when it's the jargon, like it's just so funny. And I'm sure you run into this all the time. It pitches to you and stuff that you grew up dealing with, where people will just like, I'll watch CNBC and it will be these guys that come on that have every single piece of verbiage down. And I'm like, he hasn't said shit in 5 minutes. Like he hasn't said anything. And it was, I remember it was some app and the guy was talking about it. He just kept throwing out all these terms over and over again. And I remember you guys had somebody on that was like, we were at a, you know, whatever they were asking for, hey, for 20%, we're asking for this much. And you guys immediately are like, you just gave yourself a $10 million valuation. Like, how did you come with 10 million? And then they basically were talking about the traffic of sales. They didn't own anything, but it was simply the app. And you guys were like just taking it apart. And it was so funny that they'd made it to that point and actually launched something. Yet all four or five of you were sitting there being like, this is actually not worth anything. Like I could do this tomorrow. Your sales numbers are only traffic, not anything towards your product. And it's just kind of funny and almost like awakening where these people find out on TV their business is worthless.
Yeah, some people are idiots. you know, I've said to some people, you haven't watched a show and ever. You didn't know we were going to do this. I mean, listen, and I get mad at some of the other sharks because, listen, I'm not a Silicon Valley guy. Am I in some investments out there? And do I like those things? Yes, but there's different platforms for different platforms, right? And that's not the platform where you say, I need 2% for $500,000. I mean, you know, because what it sends a bad message to the everyday people that have busted their ass and they need that opportunity. You know, you're valuing your company some crazy number and you got $500,000 in the bank and I'm just fortunate enough, you're giving me the offer. That's just not the platform to do it. And when people do that type of stuff, that valuation, you know, are they idiots? Maybe. Or did they go to a really well school up in, you know, Silicon Valley where, you know, over here is, you know, they got a million, they got 10 million, they got 50 million. And so it's their life to them. But either way, you know, I feel like an idiot if I invest in one of those companies at crazy numbers and crazy stuff like that. I might as well just give it away.
What was your reaction when you were pitched to be on the show, but they said, hey, it's going to be your money?
Yeah, I was like, these guys are certifiable pimps in Hollywood. I was like, I thought I was supposed to get screwed, not pay to get screwed. I was like, they took it to a whole nother level. I mean, I was like, I thought maybe, you know, you were trying to give me minimum wage, you know, or... but take my money? I was like, man, this pimping is real. This thing is serious in Hollywood. But, you know, at the end of the day, I understood the opportunity. I turned it down at first. I turned the show down. I turned the show down because I was kind of doing some level of management for the Kardashians, and I was putting a lot of the products on their show. And I said, oh, well, I'm going to be on this show for several times. Not a lot, like 3 minutes apiece, three separate times, 9 minutes. They said, you can't do any other show but ours. That's in the contract. And I said, well, then I can't do it. And then Kris Jenner, as well as Khloé, knew Mark Burnett, and Khloé fired me. She said, I'll never get in your way. She said, I know Mark, and Kris was like, we know Mark is going to be a big show, and you need to take this opportunity. The people in the world need to know about you. And I took the show. And well, Mark Burnett called back and was like, after they said, hey, we don't need you in the show anymore, he called back and was like, so I heard you're available. And that's how the story goes.
So you didn't want to leave the Kardashian show?
It wasn't I didn't want to leave the Kardashian show, but I'm not, you know, I never was a person who died to be in front of the camera. And as a business person, all I have is my word. And if I would have been like, hey guys, I'm leaving, you know, they would trust me. This was their first two seasons of the show. Now, would they have cared? Not really. You know, you can obviously tell they figured things out really quick. But I just felt dirty about it, you know?
All right. So here's another thing that I don't know that we have enough information on it. Hey, I'll use an example. I got really into those gold mining shows. I don't know why. The machine never breaks down as badly as you think. You know, the tractor doesn't actually turn over. The mine doesn't go bankrupt. And then I started realizing how much the guys were making to film a season. And it's so much money. They could have a disastrous season. But when the show is renewed, season 7, season 8, they're making so much money just being on the show. It doesn't even matter how well the mining goes. Is Shark Tank at a point now where, yes, it's your money, but it's still so valuable for you to just go on? Because I imagine the contracts increase with every renewal.
No. Contracts?
No.
The contract, which is a great contract, but I think the contract, if you're lucky, would break out even to the investments, if you're lucky. Now, if you're
money in, right? Not money in, what money, the right.
Correct. But I mean, if you're a drunken sailor, like you know, spending money like a drunken sailor, like Cuban, the contract is like nothing. No, absolutely not. And then the money in, I mean, you're gonna lose on probably 6 of the 10 deals. You're gonna break even probably one. You're gonna have a small hit on another one, and you are going to do really nicely on 2 out of 10.
How hard is that to understand? Because I don't think people get it. I think people on the outside would be like, oh, I'd love to do that. I'd love to start moving money around. Ooh, I'd be great. Be, you know, like, look, we get it. I'm sure people ask you all the time. And you can tell immediately that person. But how hard is it to get people to understand there's more misses? And sometimes they're just big misses, but you got to keep trying.
I don't know if it's, I don't care if they don't understand, to be very honest, because why am I trying to convince them, right? But that's just the reality of it. I mean, you know, but you know, that's the difference between people that have financial intelligence and wealth or in the market. They, you know, and the difference would be those who are not. You know, people, you know, listen, I get, you know how much slack I get. David, you liked it. Why did you buy it? Why do I got to buy the whole goddamn company? Let me buy one sponge. Why? Just because I like a sponge means I need to absorb the whole company. I mean, that's the worst thing ever. You ever went to a restaurant and you really enjoyed your time there? They're like, hey, man, why don't you be an investor? Now, I've never done this before, but if I would be an investor in the restaurant, I don't want to go back to the restaurant anymore and eat. I mean, now I got to think of all kinds of stuff. So people think that when you have money, you can just go around and their perception, understanding of it is horrible. And that's honestly why so many people are in debt or any other thing, because they don't understand how the tool of money works.
All right. Well, so give me the best example of explaining that to somebody early on.
Well, company is a bet. If you and you don't control the company, usually you are less than 51% owner of the company. So you go to Vegas and put down 10 bets. You know, how many are going to hit? You know, and you, if you're an investor in the company, the primary reason you're an investor is to let your money work for you. So if you say, well, you're an investor in the company, and how many hours of a day am I supposed to put in on all those companies? What if I put in 1 hour a day on all those companies? I'm still be working 10 hours a day. So when do I have time to run my life? What if I put in 10 hours a week on all those companies? It's not like the world is always perfect. FUBU is not Nike. Don't you think I need to go back and help FUBU out somewhat? I mean, I own all that damn company. So it's just not that easy. So when you put your money at work, you have different personalities. You have different products. You have different customers. You have the changing of how social media converts. You have retail stores dying. Where you, you know, how do you think you're going to do? Right? So especially when you're doing something on Shark Tank, you know, when you go to traditional venture capitalist companies or maybe even specific angel investors, they have a very clear criteria. You know, I have $100 million and I want to be into 10 companies. And out of the 10 companies, because I am not spending $1 million per 100 companies, I want 10 companies, simple as that. And I know that I need to increase my end goal by, you know, 20 or 30%. And I want to be out of these companies in anywhere from 5 to 7 years. I want to fund them within the first year. And I all want them to be in biotech. The way, because if they're in biotech, then I can use my CEO, my CMO, my development to work on all those companies. When you're on Shark Tank, 1 minute I got a sponge, the next minute I got lotion, the next minute I got a dog walking company, the next minute I got boots, the next minute I got this and that. So now you're fragmenting your knowledge of what you have and your time and your energy. You don't have time to that. You just send as much money as you can to the people, understand what they're going to buy with it. Because someone will come on and say, I need a $500,000 for my investment. And I go, Well, what's a $500,000 for? Well, I'm going to spend it all on advertising. You idiot, you're going to get a $5 million commercial on Shark Tank. Why the hell are you spending on advertising? You moron. So you got to always understand a lot of these things. It gets a little intricate, but after 12 years of doing it on Shark Tank and another 10 years of doing it privately, I'm just used to it.
When people talk, I would say early on, they're like, I'd love to get into this. I'd love to get in real estate. I'd love to figure out this kind of stuff. And it's the outside investing from their primary source of revenue, right? I want to be able to figure these things. I want to be an entrepreneur. And then like they turn 30 and then maybe it's 40 and you go, oh, I guess I wasn't really wired that way. And I'll explain to other people, at least in my business, like there's an element of having to be wired just a little bit differently to put up with some of the bullshit that maybe not everybody's ready to put up with, or the sacrifice of the first 10 to 15 years of being on air and all that kind of stuff. When did you first know, with your background, knowing you weren't going to school, knowing that you weren't going to be flush with cash, and you had even said in interviews, being in Queens, you didn't have a lot of role models. But when did you know you were at least wired differently to take on this kind of challenge?
I never knew that I would be, or never expected to be, at this level of taking on these type of challenges. But I think it was right around in my, I always knew I was wired differently and I wanted to be, some kind of business person. But we didn't have those type of people to look up to in, going to school and stuff like that. We didn't see those type of business people. We didn't have social media, so they would disappear in the daytime because they went to Manhattan and they worked on their businesses or worked in a corporation. So we didn't see that. The TV shows weren't showing black people that did well. There were two black people who did well on TV or who are entrepreneurs. One did really well, which is George Jefferson. And you never saw him operating the dry cleaner, though, or doing the business. You just saw him, yelling at Wheezy and dealing with his people. And the other person, you did see him operating his business, but it didn't look like Fred G. Sanford, the junk man, was doing that well. I didn't want to be around Aunt Esther and looking at Lamont. So I didn't really have the examples of seeing where it could really take you. The only people I saw of color that were doing well were athletes and musicians. So I never knew that I was built to do anything bigger. I just thought I had a hustle to be done when it really is called entrepreneurship. We didn't put a name on it back then. The name of an entrepreneur back then when I was growing up in the early 80s was somebody who set your house on fire and then comes and sells you a water hose to put out the fire. That was pretty much it. So again, I never envisioned myself here.
You've also talked about your daily routine, and it's pretty intense. So can you describe it for everyone? And then I'll obviously have a couple follow-ups.
Yeah, my daily routine of setting goals, are you talking about?
Yeah, goals, and then kind of how you stagger out the goals on a different timeline. So it's almost like you have tiers of goals going.
Sure. So the routine starts at night. It starts before I go to bed. I have 10 goals that I read every night. And I say every night, listen, I'm human, maybe 5 days a week. And sometimes I skip them for a week and I realize that I should be back on my game. But there are 10 goals, and 6 of them expire in 6 months, and the other 4 expire in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, and 20 years. I read them before I go to bed because it's the last thing I want to think about before I go to sleep. And we all know that the last thing you see or watch or listen to is what you tend to dream about. So definitely don't watch Ozark before you go to bed at night. And I wake up in the morning, I read the same damn goals. Because I wanted to be one of the first actions I take. Do I take an action on all 10 of the goals? No, not at all. But will I substitute that nasty egg and cheese sandwich I want in the morning with that green drink because I had that goal? Will I make a call towards that partner or that distribution or whatever because I know that that's where I want to grow the business? And will I make sure I call my wife and or kiss my daughters or call my mother because I know that in the goal is to have a closer relationship with them and talk to every single one of them 1 to 2 times a day? Those are my goal setting techniques. Now we can get way further deeper into it, but I know we have limited time.
No, I just think it's really important, I think, for anybody who's like kind of sitting around. I mean, I know at least for me in my mid-20s, I was like, hey, this is not working out. Like whatever you've been doing, this is not the way it's going to go. Because if it keeps going this path, and I would do something as simple as say, did you do anything today to improve your situation? It was that simple. Like at the end of the day, yeah. I'd go, did you do one thing? And that's the point, is it isn't every day. And sometimes I get annoyed with the arrogance of people that are life coaches or write a million self-help books where you just admit like, hey, there's a day where it's not happening. but it at least makes you feel like you're missing out on something when you're not following something as simple as changing your diet in the morning. Because then once you start processing it that way, it becomes official. And then you feel like it's just a little bit easier to follow. I know it sounds simple, but I just thought that was really cool of you that you admitted, like, look, I'm not saying it happens every single day, but the process alone keeps me in line.
Yeah, I think one of the things that is important as well is that is whether you do it the way you do it or the way that I do it, and there's so many other ways to do it, is the fact that when you get, or if you unfortunately get to a lower point in your life after doing it, you go, why don't I go back to doing that? You start to miss it and say, it was actually working for me. You know, it was kind of my automatic pilot that brought me back here. There's something missing. And I think that sometimes it's the loss of having it that says, wait a minute, you dumb shit, you got here from doing that. Why aren't you doing that again?
Yeah. You also talked a little bit about, you know, the excuse making, because people will just find a way. And it was a really funny point. It was like, hey, don't watch every episode of Game of Thrones this weekend. You know, like, there you go. Just cut that down. Because whenever somebody says, I don't have time, I know different challenges, and I'm a guy without a family, so I don't really have to worry about it as much. So I'm not trying to compare myself to anyone else. But I feel like anytime I hear somebody say that, I'm like, you've already decided then. You've kind of, you pretend you want these things, but deep down you don't.
You set a goal. I don't have time. That's the goal you set. That's a conscious goal. A goal doesn't have to be a good goal. I'm always going to be in a damn abusive relationship. I'm never going to get anywhere in life. You just set a goal. If you're doing that 10 times a day, I grew up in a neighborhood where we said, we're fucked. We'll all be dead or in jail by 21. Now, maybe other people told us that, but they gave us that gift to then share with each other. So a goal is a goal.
Yeah, that's
good or bad.
That's right. So as you're looking at everything that's gone on, like, I don't know, you know, kind of what the rest of your portfolio looks like. And, you can share or not share whatever you want, but it's a really weird time because the market's on fire, yet it still feels like how serious is this? Is it temporary? How much have you adjusted your investment strategy or how you're doing things with trying to navigate kind of where we're at right now? Because it's been a weird 12 months.
Yeah, listen, I've been wrong for about 80% of my decisions during this period of time, investment decisions. I have been, I don't know, maybe I'm going on 90% of being absolutely wrong.
What have you been wrong about? Wrong.
Oh, are you kidding me? I shorted the market, you know, because, the market was at 16 4 years ago and we're already at 30. I was like, no way in the world can you grow basically almost double through the course of the last 80 years of being in the market and sustain this amount. It's going to go back down. And when it went down to 16 for that quick blip, I didn't double down. I saw it come back up to 22. I said, it's going back down. That sucker shot to 31. I was looking at my money going, God damn, I used to love that money. So that was gone.
It's an awful feeling logging on some days.
Yeah, you know, last year, my friends were like, and I had a bunch of Bitcoin. I was like, this shit ain't going nowhere. Pew! Went to the top because I dropped it all. I dropped it. I got rid of it. I was like, And I'm sitting there, I said, Damon, you idiot. You could have.
What'd you get rid of it at?
I got rid of it like $6,000.
Did you have it at 20 on the front side of it? And then, like, were you trying to cover the losses?
I had it about three.
Yeah.
No, I had it about three. And it went up to 19. I said, cool. Went back down. I was like, Then I was like, hey, honey, unfortunately, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to, you know, they're not going to be able to keep their stores and all that shit. We're going to build a house and all that. So we're going to get everything at discount. I mean, everything we want our store. I mean, everything we want our home. Everything. I mean, it's going to be discount. I'm still waiting for a goddamn toaster that I paid 10x for because everybody sold out of every goddamn thing. You know, so everything I've been wrong about. I was like, we're going into a depression. Things are going to be on fire sale. The only thing that's not on fire sale is the things that people need at home because everybody's home. I mean, this is ridiculous. So I've been absolutely wrong on all those. However, I have the luxury of being able to know the market. We'll come back. It'll go up and down. I adjusted some of that. But the 30% of my companies that were kind of like the walking dead and the sooner or later going to die, as Kevin O'Leary would say, take them up behind the barn. Let's get it over with right now. So I saved time with the 30%. The other 30% that I was like, skyrocketed. And then we got 30% in the middle now that I need to concentrate on. And then I'm being able to reevaluate my time. And either fortunately or unfortunately, with social crisis, I'm one of the only deemed successful people of color that have nothing to do with music, sports, or politics. And because there needs to be an amplified voice, because I think we have more than in a common than we do apart. I'm looking at a lot of board seats as well as startups and places where I think I can add value that will have a significant social impact. So I'm starting to do more of that than I had done in the past, because I think that people are actually coming around and saying we need to make some real change. So, you know, as it goes up, it goes down. You know, you learn from your mistakes and you value your opportunities.
First of all, I love your honesty, because most people, you know, especially with your profile, maybe don't want to be that honest, but I'll only just share with you as just a guy that, you know, is reads and watches and in your spare time and screws around with it and has had awful runs and decent ones. But when it was at 17, I was like, okay, look, just buy the tech stuff up, just buy it up. And so good run. And then I wanted to get back in real estate. So I got rid of it. And then I could look at where it's at now. And I had to learn that lesson too. Like, whatever it's at now isn't your fucking money. So stop looking at it and doing the calculation. Like, I've got one friend that's been bitching about Netflix for 20 years. And we're like, guess what, dude? You would have sold it at some other point. So stop complaining about not going all in on Netflix in 1999. Like, Jesus, get over it. And when I look at where, you know, the market is now, and like, people listening to this are going to be all over the place with it. And when I look at like, sneakers is something that's crazy, because it's on fire. Like, it's absolutely the secondary market for sneakers. And I go, okay, so what's going on? I think part of the retail explosion online is boredom. I think a lot of it is a financial decision where you're really kicking the bigger problem down the street a little bit. Where I look at real estate and higher end places where you thought eventually had a cool off, because we're already past where we were in 2008. And I'll go, okay, what's happening? And some of it's connected to the rates and all that stuff. But now that stuff is on fire again. Mm-hmm. And I go, when is the bill going to come due for 2020? So I don't blame you or anybody for not only shorting, just doubting where we're at right now. And that's what scares the hell out of me.
We are going to have to pay the piper. And people, it's going to be a definite misunderstanding when we have to pay the piper. People are going to be like, how? Oh my God, how dare? I mean, but it is going to happen. So be prepared for it. Diversify. I'm seeing everybody move to Miami. And I moved out of New York. You know what I need to do? I need to get another place in New York. You know what I mean? Right now. Because it's just going to keep switching around, right? So, you know, so.
So. Early on, it is a bunch of alphas in that room on Shark Tank. There had to be a couple times where maybe early on you're like, I'm just not going to be able to fuck with this guy. Like, I can't. I don't like him. Like, I know it's a TV show. I may have respect for the other guy, but I can't. Was it harder for you in the beginning? Because you said you didn't even really want to be in front of the camera, where you felt like maybe the show element was going to hurt a relationship with somebody you've now worked with for maybe 10 years.
No, I didn't. I never had a problem with anybody, except for I had an initial problem with Bethany when she came on the show, because I had an encounter with her on some show or something like that, and she was cold or a certain way. And listen, you're not supposed to kiss my ass, but she was just so you know, now I have no idea what she could have been going through, but you know, it's kind of like a colleague thing, a professional thing. Hey, how you doing? Da, 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 da. And she was very much so. And my limited knowledge of her was, you know, the women on, you know, obviously the show, that there's a lot of drama where she will admit that, you know, they're drinking and talking shit.
Housewives. Yeah.
Right. Housewives. So, yeah. So she comes on and absolutely amazing. Fell in love with her. She was about the entrepreneur. She gave a shit. She knew her brand. And the reality is, you know, like, one of my buddies said to, he was telling me a story. He was like, he was in a car with somebody and said, you know, going to meet this person, they're an asshole. And he was like, you haven't met the person? He said, no. He said, well, if you think they're an asshole, you never met them. Well, you're the asshole, you know? So, Bethany and I are very close now, but that was the only person I ever was like, and I think the reason why I had the problem was because I said to myself, as her being a woman and me having this whatever feeling, if I lock horns with her, I don't want to lock horns in the wrong way and I then be perceived as, you know, somebody who does not have a certain level of respect for women.
Now, you've been pretty adamant, and I think in a very specific way that I haven't heard, but explain your reasoning why you think females are just built to be better entrepreneurs, that they have an advantage, essentially. What is that?
Well, I think that males are often intimidated by them. I think that women have a way to, because, you know, you can, you know, listen, we're a human. I think that you can visually look at a woman and your perception of a powerful woman or a beautiful woman is, you know, we've always been in the position where we need to find a way to pitch ourselves to, you know, if you're a straight male, we have to find a way to pitch ourselves to a woman, right? You know, that's the way it is. So I think that they can be intimidating sometimes, but I think they also have this ability to listen and be nurturing and know that, you know, and I guess, listen, it's because I'm surrounded by all women, you know, my mother or my wife, my current wife, my ex-wife, they had a way of looking at me when I'm doing what I'm doing and looking at me and going, is that right? And making, and, you know, really understanding that you're just, because the ego is not the same position as that, understand, looking at you almost like a little boy with a snotty nose and a blanket trying to get their way and go, okay, honey, you know, kind of way. They have a certain way about them, as well as they're very, very analytical. I mean, if you've ever had a wife or a girlfriend or anybody else, they can break down things and they take the time. I'm the big idea kind of guy. I've just seen that I've been very, very productive with women as at the helm of my companies and the helm of my life. So that's just my experience.
Yeah, the company side, I think that's good. I think personally, I'm all set with being broken down much more at this point in my life. So if we have listeners that, you know, maybe they've run into a little bit of money, they want to figure out a way to get in investing. You know, everybody has different views on real estate. And honestly, it really only matters if you understand the market of where you're buying the real estate. But what would your, are there lessons from the books? Are there things that you still believe in now that are like, look, I did it my way. You might do it differently, but here's just some simple things you would share with people about understanding and trying to be an entrepreneur that's going out there and putting some money around.
Sure. The first investment is in yourself. And money only highlights your weaknesses in many cases. So if the first investment is yourself, is if you want to get in the market, well, you know, it doesn't cost you that much to get the software to sink or swim from TD Ameritrade and play with the software. Now, if you think you're going to be Gordon Gekko all of a sudden in the first week, and because you want to play with, you know, 1,000 or 100 or a million, then you're not that bright. I mean, you know, you're only trying to take a shortcut. True entrepreneurs. So whether, you know, we're talking about you as a broadcaster, you know, every day when you got up, you learned something new, or you learned what not to do, or you learned where somebody was going and it was really good for them. And you learned about the 10 other people that are no longer in the area because they thought that it was an overnight sensation and they had no overnight success. And they had no, you know, they had no real drive for the industry itself. They didn't want to learn more because they didn't find it fascinating. And they wanted immediate gratification.
Right, their schedule. And that happens to everybody. It's like, man, your schedule is not, your plan is not everybody else's schedule.
It's not. And so if you want to learn that market, that other area, the smart way to do it is don't quit your damn day job and put in a couple of extra hours in the place that you want to be, educating yourself and, you know, grow it then and then see how else you can learn and keep bringing a lot of other people around because it's a team sport. And continue to grab mentorship. So, I mean, but it ends up being your why. Why do you want to do it? Because you heard that people in real estate do really well. When I started off with shirts, it wasn't glamorous. You know, when I'm in the middle of a hood and hip hop culture, which is a very, at that time, and even till today, it's a very homophobic culture. When the only designers we saw back in the 80s were flamboyant, you know, males out of France and Italy, people didn't talk to me in my neighborhood. They were like, hey, man, we're going to go over here and sell some drugs. We're going to go over here and catch some girls. I used to be like, man, I got the strawberry pattern. I'm going to go home and I'm going to make this really nice hat. It was like, ooh, I see. You know what I mean? But I didn't care. That was their problem. You know what I mean?
I bought a FUBU tank in 99, I think. Yellow. And we used to have certain nights we would bartend and it would be on. And I kept one yellow FUBU tank forever because I knew once it came back around, it was going to be hilarious that I had it 20 years after I bought it.
That's right.
Every move I've made, I'd be like, No, I'm keeping it. So, hey, man, it was really cool talking to you. We all love the show here on this end. And if you can ever repay the favor, let us know. All right.
All right. I appreciate you. Thank you so much, man. Stay safe and happy new year.
Yeah, you too. I am so pumped for Conor McGregor, Dustin Poirier, and that rematch is taking place this Saturday. And really, the question is this. What are you thinking? McGregor again in the first round by TKO, or does Poirier make him tap? Well, guess what? You can make those bets on FanDuel Sportsbook. They've got so many different ways to get in on the action. And right now, when you open a FanDuel account, new users can unlock a 25-1 odds on either fighter to win. That means you can turn $5 into $125. Okay, looking at the odds here on FanDuel right now, McGregor's around a minus 300, depending on where you look at this thing. Poirier's plus 245. So with the odds boost there, I mean, the safer play here is McGregor. I was watching the preview of the first fight, too, again, and it was just really nasty leading up to this one. So there you go. And if you want to check it all out, you know that FanDuel is so easy to use. Just download the FanDuel Sportsbook app and use the promo code Ryan, R-Y-E-N, to unlock 25-1 odds. And also remember that FanDuel Sportsbook is now live in Michigan. So for our Michigan listeners, that's FanDuel Sportsbook, promo code Ryan, R-Y-E-N. Must be 21 or older, present in Colorado, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, or West Virginia. New users only. Max bonus $125, minimum $10 first deposit required. Restrictions apply. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-522-4700, Colorado, 1-800-BETS-OFF, Iowa, 1-800-9-WITH-IT, Indiana, 1-800-GAMBLER, New Jersey, PA, Illinois, Tennessee, Redline, 1-800-889-9789, Tennessee, or visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net, West Virginia.
You want details? Bye. I drive a Ferrari, 355 Cabriolet.
What's up?
I have a ridiculous house in the South Fork. I have every toy you can possibly imagine.
And best of all, kids, I am liquid. So, now you know what's possible. Let me tell you what's required.
Got a lot of homeowner issues lately, so that's cool. We do have the fitness ones, but we don't have our guest. We know who we're using, but we haven't booked it yet that way. Okay, here we go. Longtime listener. Oh, this guy's a big guy, 6'4", 240. People keep bringing in the stats. That's fine. That's cool. Anyway, he and his girlfriend bought a house together this summer in Orange County. It's everything we want, a great neighborhood, flip renovated before we moved in, a corner lot, one neighbor on one side and one directly behind with a shared wall. When we moved in, the neighbor behind us had a large patio umbrella that split our back wall and was half in their yard and half in ours. Not a huge deal overall, but it was a bit of an eyesore. Our house has been renovated for about 6 months before we moved in, so we just assumed the neighbors would notice someone had moved in and moved the umbrella fully to their side. This did not happen. All right, here we go. To make matters worse, over the first few weeks, every Friday and Saturday night, our neighbors would have loud pool parties and play techno music until about 12 or 1 techno in the morning. Music. I love to drink and have a good time as much as the next guy, but it was getting excessive multiple times over these first few weeks. I walked over to the neighbor's house and knocked on the door in hopes of finally meeting face-to-face, getting to know each other, and hopefully coming to some sort of amicable agreement on music, loud noise, etc. Unfortunately, no one ever answered the door. Who's living here? Jesse Pinkman? This is nuts. No one answered the door. All right, so we could not figure out exactly who lived in the house. 4 weeks in, after ragers on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights, the neighbors got it going again on Sunday night. Since this was the fourth night in a row, my patience was gone as my girlfriend and I were laying in bed at 12:30 a.m. We heard a loud bang against the sliding glass door in our living room. I jumped out of bed, went outside, and found a smashed vape pen on the ground that someone had chucked over the wall from the neighbor's party. I was seething mad. My girlfriend begged. So in the middle of the night, you found a vape pen? You have the eyes of an eagle, man. All right, so seething mad, my girlfriend begged me not to go over to the house that late, so I chucked a broken vape pen back over the wall and called the cops. Pretty understandable at this point. I think almost everyone so far is leaning your way in this. Okay. Called the cops. Police say they'd go check it out. It's also in August in the middle of the pandemic. Hey, the Orange County has decided the pandemic. Florida, Scottsdale, and the OC apparently have all said, we're good on your pandemic. They're treating it like a science that they don't believe in. All right. Things are quiet during the week, so we thought maybe the cops had an impact. But on the next Friday night, party started back up again. And Saturday morning, I woke up and went into our backyard and found multiple beer bottle caps and cigarette butts had been tossed over the wall. Ooh. I immediately walked to the neighbor's house and started knocking. Finally, someone answered the door, introduced myself as the neighbor. sharing the wall. The guy said he lived there with his dad and that he was 23 years old. I said, that's great. Nice to meet you. Small talk, blah, blah, blah. Finally, as I was getting ready to leave after a 5-minute conversation, I said, hey, two other things. One, would you mind moving your umbrella completely over to your side of the wall? We'd really appreciate it not hanging over on our side. And two, I'm all for partying and having a good time, but could you please lower the music around 12? And please don't have anyone throwing trash in my yard. He said, oh, yeah, of course, no problem. I thought to myself, great combo. Common ground, we should be good. All right. Now, since he said he lived with his dad and the parties were going on, we assumed the dad was out of town. And a couple days later, lo and behold, the umbrella was moved off our side. However, a couple days after that, we heard the dad again in the backyard. And the next day, the umbrella was back where it was before and was half in our yard. All right. So they don't care about you and the umbrella at all. They clearly don't care about you at all. So we're just going to get that one out of the way if you hadn't already figured that one out. To make matters worse, my girlfriend and I went on a walk later that evening. As we passed by their fence, we heard the kid talking shit about us to their neighbors. They called the cops. They're lame. They asked us to move the umbrella. Guy's an asshole. After all this, I was just over it and didn't want any more issues. So we let the umbrella be. A month later, I'm building a pergola in our backyard. It was up on the ladder. The neighbor, the dad who I hadn't met, was on his roof spraying something down. Unsolicited, he calls out to me and says, hey, I just want to let you know I ordered a new umbrella. I have a TV mounted on the wall, so I need the umbrella for shade. I bought one of those half umbrellas and it should arrive in a few weeks. I said, that sounds great. Thank you so much. Appreciate the heads up and the understanding. Fast forward to now. It's been 3 months since that conversation, and the same dumb umbrella is still there and half in our yard. Do I drop it forever and let these neighbors punk me with their umbrella? Do I try to talk to them again about it reasonably, or do I go full deconstructo mode and take a Sawzall to the half of the umbrella in my yard? Okay, he sent a picture. I'm going to tell you right now, if I were a judge, this picture is not doing our emailer any favors, because it actually, from the angle, it doesn't look like it's all the way over or it's half over on you, or you know, the wall seems really high. And so you're seeing their umbrella and you're kind of like, whatever. All right. So I'm not ruling against our guy that emailed in here. I'm just saying this picture for this umbrella, it seems like a huge amount of shit that you're dealing with here about this umbrella angle. I'm also used to seeing everything else, because where I live, everything's on top of each other anyway. So we just, like, you don't even think about it that way. But I get it. This is a house. It's a lot, slightly different, although I'm sure it's probably a packed neighborhood in the OC. The bigger issue is that he just doesn't care at all. He doesn't care about anything. And then oddly enough, the dad doesn't seem to care about anything. Like, you have to be, I would say early 20s, you kind of don't understand. You just are like, what are you talking about? I'm in my 20s. People want to come over. And because it's a pandemic, he's having more house parties. And there's no process. Look, I was that neighbor when I was really young. I just didn't even think. I'd be like, why would you not want to listen to Ludacris at 20, you know, at 2-3 in the morning? Like, that's a me problem. And you're just an asshole, you know, like, and you kind of know, like, oh, you know what? I probably shouldn't do that. But you don't care. You just don't care, because you're young and you're stupid and you're arrogant. And you're kind of like, man, why is this guy giving me such a hard time? So I really think the only thing you can do here, the umbrella thing, you're obviously just going to lose on. You know, I think you are. I would give up on the umbrella deal. But the party thing was so much more disrespectful. And the fact that clearly, oh, this asshole neighbor, and they decided, like, I would never do that. I would never go, oh, this neighbor complained, so now let's throw garbage over the wall into his place. Because that means, so this guy has no respect for you at all. And it doesn't seem like the dad does either. This actually sounds like a classic OC family. Shout out to Orange County. I think you're going to fight fire with fire on this and just go right back at him, where you throw an all-timer with COVID restrictions passing. So you might have to wait a while here. We don't want to endorse anything. And you go hard at like 3 fucking a.m. All right? Like, that's when it starts. And you maybe get a bullhorn and say, hey, we're going to, you guys think you go hard? We're going to go Mykonos hard on this side of the wall. And just go for it. And it'll be hilarious, because you probably wouldn't ever do it anyway. Have it be so late, so obnoxious, music that you can't even pick up with Siri, where they're like, don't know. I think it's Turkish. And just rage without giving any fucks about these neighbors and hope they come over and go, yep. That's what it's like. I love my dad. He's got a really odd, funny streak in him at times. And he drove me back up to school during a snowstorm once. So I had to be, my freshman year. And we were stuck in this dumpy motel. He was not the kind of guy that was going to splurge in a hotel room ever, by the way. And there was a couple next to us that was just raging all night, smoking cigarettes. It stunk so bad. They're making all sorts of noise. You know, we'd driven all the way up from Martha's Vineyard to get to Burlington in a snowstorm, which is, you know, if you've ever done that drive through the Northeast, it takes forever and it's kind of hairy. I mean, normally it could be 5 hours, but with snow, you never know. I mean, it's taken me 11 hours, I think, in the past, like if I hit it wrong. And so we were miserable. I had to move into the dorm because I couldn't get in, you know, when we drove back up. And we were both tired and it's cold. And the, you know, like the motel sucked. It was our call. What was his call? And my father was so pissed about the bad night of sleep that he turned the TV up as loud as he possibly could to a Canadian station that was playing cartoons in French. So if you think there's an annoying sound of music or an annoying TV show or just a loud conversation, hungover 7 a.m. French cartoons, like French Tom and Jerry, has to be one of the worst things to wake up to. So he turned the TV on the TV cart, turned it all the way up, and it was like, all right, Rod, let's get out of here. I can't imagine what it was like to wake up to that hungover and then try to figure it out. And we're already checked out and, you know, they're banging on the door. I don't know. So I just feel for you on this one because the kid isn't going to get it. He isn't going to get it. He thinks you're the bad guy.
That made me feel so gross from like sophomore year until like, I guess, until like
last week.
No. But like until probably 20, till I turned 21. And it wasn't weird that I was like drinking. Like, I don't know how many years that is. That's a lot of years. There was at my dad's house, there was like his fence. We shared like there was like a no man's land situation between two fences between our yards. You know what I mean? Where it's like, I don't know, maybe like 3 feet across of like, you know, there's trees and there's fences and then there's really nothing in between. There's no reason for anyone to ever go in that area between the two properties' fences. And it was cigarettes and beers because I didn't want my parents to find, you know, like thinking they would go in the garbage or something. So for, I mean, maybe 8 years of just me and my friends, cigarettes and beer cans and bottles. And then one day my dad was getting the trees cleared out and I went with him because I was like, I got to see what this looks like. I just didn't think anyone would ever have to see it. And the neighbor walked up and he was like, oh, there's some stuff back here. He's like, yeah, I've been cleaning it out for years. And I just fucking kind of like folded into myself that this guy has been like, the guy was like 65 at the time. So he was already probably near retirement when I started the little stash back there. And I just thought, oh my God, this man's been cleaning up my and my stupid friend's beers and cigarette butts for 8 years. I don't know. So I just thought it was like an abyss, but no, that guy checked and would just go back there with garbage bags apparently. So that story made me feel really gross because I had a flashback to that.
Yeah. I mean, it's part of growing up.
I never thought about it.
But like, I remember, I mean, I'm not going to do another life advice. So this will just turn into a little bit of a story time thing, but God, I'm embarrassed to admit this, but we got our hands on a ton of fake snow, you know, like that you do on your windows. So it looks like the windows are frosted around Christmas time.
Yeah.
I don't know. We had to have had it from a house party or something stupid. And so we just had a ton. And then we used to constantly do like graffiti on each other's cars. And one guy wrote on like the back of a kid's, I don't know, it was like an RX-7. Does that make sense, Kyle? Can we get research on what an RX-7 is? Yeah. Let's just put it this way. It wasn't a sweet car. Okay. Now it wasn't even this one. This is like a 95. It was a Mazda something and it wasn't awesome. Because the funny thing is, like, I wasn't a guy that had money when I was in college, you know, and we would have roommates. You couldn't fathom. Like, a roommate would go pick out a fucking Land Rover Discovery because it snowed. Be like, oh, my parents, you know, be like, dude, you have a Tahoe. Like, oh, my parents are just not uncomfortable, you know, with the conditions up here. So, you know, they wanted me to upgrade it. And, you know, next thing you know, kids driving back with a fully paid for Land Rover Discovery. And these would be our friends, right? It just was, UVM was crazy that way. And then, you know, me and this another kid who was from Mass. And by the way, even when my father started doing better, the last thing he was ever going to do was buy me a car at 20, 21. Never. It was never going to happen. And I just remember all of a sudden, like spring break or closer to graduation, everybody was rocking these brand new cars. And it was always kind of a reminder too. You're like, oh, this is how rich some of our friends are. This is fucking crazy. And, one of the other kids who was from Woburn, Mass. I mean, he wasn't from a family that had money. I mean, shit, he thought I was rich because I was from Martha's Vineyard. And again, my father started doing like better as I got older. And so at that point it had like zero impact on me at all. So they wrote a huge Ida, you fill in the blank, on the back of his Mazda shitbox. And we left it there for like 2 days in a neighborhood with people that were walking dogs and kids that were getting onto bus stops. And I thought it was the funniest thing. And one of the other guys who lived in the house, and we're all the same age. And he goes, hey guys, like, just going to give you a heads up. Like, we shouldn't be doing stuff like that. We shouldn't be doing something like, yeah, we're all making fun of it. We're spraying fake snow stuff on each other's cars. And, you know, we shouldn't. And seriously, half of us in the room are looking at him like, what's wrong with this guy? Like, where, you know, and he was right. He was totally right. But sometimes you're just so wrapped up, especially when you're younger, because you just have less, you know, you have more storage and less has gone on. So you're wrapped up in your present day, probably more often than you are as you get a little bit older. And I'm embarrassed. Look, I'm embarrassed to share the story, but I also don't think it's that crazy of a thing. Like in that moment, I'm going, wait, what? And now I look back and I'm horrified going, some parent was walking their daughter to a bus stop and, you know, they'd be like, what's that? And you're just like, oh, it's these terrible six guys that, you know, and that was the weird thing about Burlington, Vermont, is that you'd have these old neighborhood stretches, but then they would get overrun. Like if there was a old timey house that had three floors, maybe it's got three units. So college kids are going to be the people renting it out. And we rented out this massive house. There's like six of us in six bedrooms and nobody else is really going to rent that house out other than college kids. So, you know, Burlington would also do this thing where they pass all these town laws during the summer when no one was around and they were all just set up to hammer every college kid. And all that stuff started actually really changing while I was there too. So like we came back our senior year and then we're like, wait, 24-hour noise violations? Like when did this get passed? So like it's August. I'm like, oh, okay. So anyway, not all that insightful, but if you're maybe really a lot younger that's listening to this podcast, just like Kyle said, like you kind of turning into yourself where you go, oh,
the world is bigger than your driveway or that space between the fences. Like,
yeah. And unfortunately for our guy that emails in here, this kid doesn't care. And if his dad doesn't care, then this kid is ranked. He's like a 2 seed in the East region of not caring of people.
His dad's backing him up. Yeah. You got no
shot. Right, yeah. If the dad is backing him up, and he's throwing garbage. Because the problem is if you escalate it, I don't know. I'm with you. I mean, I'd have a hard time just going, oh, I don't want to keep this going. But you know, you're just going to have to, maybe the next party they have you film all the garbage. You send the video to the dad and you go, like even you as an adult, you would have to admit this is super fucked up and it has to stop. And if that guy's like, yeah, whatever, my kid's awesome. I don't know. Maybe join a biker gang. Let's not do that right away. Just think it out loud. Just stuff, you know, spitballing here. Have a great weekend. Enjoy the games. We'll be back and previewing the Super Bowl.